Thursday, January 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Okwo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. calls Russia's action towards Ukraine an immediate challenge to peace and stability in Europe.
We condemn Russia's military buildup on Ukraine's borders, as well as Moscow's increasingly harsh rhetoric, as it continues to push the false narrative that Ukraine seeks to provoke a conflict with Russia.
North Korea tests a suspected ballistic missile, its first launch of the new year.
North Korea welcomed the new year with a missile launch. Japanese officials say it traveled for 500 kilometers before splashing into the sea off Korea's east coast.
And the deadliest single fire in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania in at least a century killed 13 people, including 7 children. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that Russia's actions towards Ukraine are an immediate and urgent challenge to peace and stability in Europe. He made his comments on Wednesday after talks with German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock. Blinken said the two also discussed the status of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, adding that he reaffirmed Washington's commitment to work with Germany to prevent Russia from using energy as a weapon.
Both Germany and the United States see Russia's actions toward Ukraine as an immediate and urgent challenge to peace and stability in Europe. We condemn Russia's military buildup on Ukraine's borders, as well as Moscow's increasingly harsh rhetoric, as it continues to push the false narrative that Ukraine seeks to provoke a conflict with Russia. In our joint statement in July, Germany and the United States also agreed to work together to support Ukraine's energy security and to prevent Russia from using energy as a weapon. The foreign minister and I reaffirmed that commitment today. We also discussed the status of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which the United States has long opposed. As I said before, this pipeline does not have gas flowing through it at present. And if Russia renews its aggression toward Ukraine, it would certainly be difficult to see gas flowing through it in the future. So some may see Nord Stream 2 as leverage that Russia can use against Europe. In fact, it's leverage for Europe to use against Russia. We are regularly evaluating the assistance that would be necessary and helpful to Ukraine to defend itself. And will continue to deliver equipment and supplies to Ukraine in the weeks and months ahead through a range of mechanisms, including the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative and other means as needed.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The European Union's top diplomat visited the front lines of Ukraine's war with Moscow-backed forces on Wednesday. Josep Borrell promised, quote, massive consequences and severe costs, unquote, for Russia if it launched a new military offensive against its neighbor. He flew by helicopter to the easterly Luhansk region, the first EU high representative to do so since the outbreak of the conflict in 2014. This as part of a Western diplomatic push in support of Ukraine. Kyiv and its allies have sounded the alarm over the buildup of tens of thousands of Russian troops and military equipment near Ukraine's borders in recent weeks, raising fears of an open war between the two ex-Soviet neighbors. The Kremlin did not immediately issue a public response to Borrell's visit. Moscow has previously denied planning a new military offensive against Ukraine and accuses Kyiv of building up its own forces in the east of the country.
The will to de-escalate through dialogue, to avoid increasing tensions, to look for solutions, but with a firm stance and with the strong commitment that any military aggression against Ukraine would have a massive consequences and severe costs. And we are coordinating with the US, with NATO, and other like-minded partners in order to look, work for this de-escalation and the full implementation of the Minsk Agreement. The conflict on the borders is on the verge of getting deeper, and tensions has been building up with respect to the European security as a whole. But there is no security in Europe without the security of Ukraine. And it is clear that any discussion on European security must include the European Union and Ukraine. Any discussion about Ukraine must involve Ukraine, first of all. And to talk about the security in Europe cannot be done without not only the consultation, but the participation of the Europeans.
That's Josep Borrell, European High Representative for Foreign Affairs. President Joe Biden has directed his administration to buy an additional 10 million courses of Pfizer's COVID-19 pill Paxlovid. The purchase brings the total to at least 20 million courses as part of his strategy to combat Omicron. He addressed the American public this week as COVID-19 cases in the U.S. surged to record levels following the holidays. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara has this report.
Residents of Washington, D.C. turned out for a snowball fight earlier this week, a sign of normalcy in a winter marked by soaring COVID-19 cases in the United States yet again. Fueled by the Omicron variant, on Monday, the nation's coronavirus cases reached a world record of 1 million detected in 24 hours, according to a report by the Johns Hopkins University.
Today, I'm directing my team to work with Pfizer to double our order from 10 million to 20 million treatment courses to be delivered in the months ahead.
On Tuesday, President Joe Biden outlined his administration's strategy to address Omicron. In addition to buying more Pfizer COVID-19 pills, he promised to make booster shots and testing more widely available. With Americans having to wait in long lines to get tested, Biden has been blamed for delays and shortages. His administration has not given details on the distribution of the promised half a billion free at-home test kits. Testing is considered key to limit Omicron spread and reduce hospitalization. Dr. William Schaffner is an infectious disease professor at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine.
We can't do very much about inhibiting the spread of this extraordinarily contagious virus. And if it only produces mild disease, we could, if you will, quote, tolerate that while we try to continue to prevent these hospitalizations.
More evidence is emerging that Omicron causes milder symptoms than previous variants, in some places resulting in lower death rates despite soaring case numbers. World Health Organization incident manager Abdi Mohamud.
We are seeing more and more studies pointing out that Omicron is infecting the upper part of the body, unlike other ones, the lung, who has been causing severe pneumonia. It can be a good news, but we really require more studies to prove that.
The U.S. has donated more than 315 million vaccine doses globally, while pledging a total of 1.2 billion doses. Yet some health experts say wealthy nations are not doing enough to vaccinate the world and prevent the emergence of new variants. Dr. Peter Hotez is the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine.
Until we redouble our commitment to vaccinate the African continent, Southeast Asia, and Latin America, we're always going to have this problem. And that's what has to be prioritized. And so far, neither the U.S. government or the G7 countries have really made that commitment.
On Monday, U.S. health authorities approved Pfizer's booster shot for children as young as 12, with a final approval expected in the coming days. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Australia recorded on Wednesday a new daily record of more than 50,000 COVID-19 cases. Hospital admissions continue to rise. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
This is the first time that daily COVID-19 case numbers have exceeded 50,000 in Australia. The most populous state, New South Wales, recorded 35,000 new infections on Wednesday. Neighbouring Victoria reported 17,636 new cases, most are caused by the Omicron variant. Health authorities believe that case numbers will continue to increase in the weeks to come and will plateau in February. In Queensland, health officials warned that infections would surge, certainly into the hundreds of thousands. Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk said in most of the cases, symptoms were mild and people were recovering very, very quickly. Testing clinics have been unable to cope with the huge demand for screening, and rapid antigen tests are in short supply. Hospitalizations are increasing in parts of Australia, but officials believe most patients in intensive care units have the Delta variant. Susan Pearce, Deputy Secretary of the New South Wales Health Department, says demands on the hospital system will grow.
We expect for the next several weeks that we will see that pressure. We also expect, though, that once it starts to decline, it will likely decline quite quickly. But we have got some challenging weeks ahead of us. Everything that can be done to support our staff will be done as we work through this. What we've demonstrated during the course of this pandemic now for 2 years is that our health system is capable of almost anything.
Despite the surge, theatres in Sydney and Melbourne are declaring on with the show and reopening. An international cricket match between Australia and England in Sydney attracted thousands of spectators. In total, about 550,000 COVID-19 infections have been diagnosed in Australia since the pandemic began. 2,282 people have died. Australia's political leaders have said that the country's best defence against rising coronavirus cases is high vaccination levels. More than 91% of the population over age 16 is fully inoculated. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A year after the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol building, former President Donald Trump continues to insist that the 2020 vote was rigged. In recent months, the former president has pushed Republicans and state legislators to change election laws. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
I know that everyone here will soon be marching over the Capitol.
This is the face that launched thousands of angry people on the U.S. Capitol in one of the most stunning days in American history. The few thousand protesters who ended up entering the Capitol that January day sought out lawmakers, in particular House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and former Vice President Mike Pence, as they attempted to formalize Joe Biden's victory over Donald Trump in the November 2020 presidential election. The mob erected gallows, assaulted police and journalists, vandalized, and looted offices. The violence and chaos left five people dead, wounded 138 police officers, resulted in charges against more than 720 participants, and landed Trump a last-minute impeachment, his second, just days before he left office. Trump maintains the poll was rigged in the face of overwhelming evidence that there was no election fraud, as do some of his supporters, who continue to attend his post-presidential rallies.
I'm here to see our rightful president that actually won this election, and I just want to hear what he has to say.
Trump was planning to address his followers again this coming January 6th, but he canceled the event and says he'll instead address his followers at a rally planned for January 15th in Arizona. Observers say he's been busy all year trying to influence sympathetic lawmakers. Jeremy Suri, a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin, via Skype.
So he's trying to limit voting access in states that have diverse populations or ever more diverse populations like Georgia and Texas. He's trying to get people like Jim Jordan and Marjorie Taylor Greene, two members of Congress, to get them more of their own kind of people elected who will do things such as pursue policies designed to keep immigrants out of the United States, policies designed to take the United States out of its international alliances, like the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So he has an America First agenda, he has an ego agenda, and he has an agenda about trying to rewrite history to match his false narrative, and he's pursuing that every day.
If anything, says analyst Suzanne Spaulding, who leads the Defending Democratic Institutions Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, this galvanizing event has only further divided the United States politically. Republicans who spoke out against Trump right after January 6th seem to have gone silent in the past year. More troubling, she said, polls show that one in three Americans believes violence against the government is justified. This seems to have given Trump fuel.
I suspect in that sense he has felt emboldened. I think there was, again, in the very first hours after that, those events, a sense among some of Republican members of Congress that perhaps he had gone too far and that they thought they had some breathing room to distance themselves. And unfortunately, what seems to have happened is that he has not lost his grip on the Republican Party.
Biden will speak before Congress on the afternoon of the 6th, says White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And he will continue to bring up Trump's responsibility.
I don't think we've held back on this front. I mean, President Trump's role in subverting our Constitution, attempting to block the peaceful transfer of power, and defending a mob that attacked our Capitol and law enforcement has been well documented. And it's something, obviously, the president spoke about in terms of that being one of the worst days in our democracy.
Trump will likely reference Biden's words during the January 15th rally. But Spaulding says the American people, not politicians, deserve the last word here. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
1 year after supporters of former President Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol in a bid to overturn Joe Biden's 2020 election victory, hundreds of people are still awaiting trial for their alleged role in the riot, while 155 others have pleaded guilty. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, the pending cases are just one part of the effort to hold accountable parties responsible for the attack.
1 year later, there are still questions about the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol and who was ultimately responsible for the worst attack on the seat of Congress in two centuries. Many of former President Trump's supporters claim the breach was not serious, while critics say Trump directed his supporters to overturn Joe Biden's election victory, effectively undermining the democratic process. Rioters roamed the halls of the Capitol building, raising security concerns for lawmakers and staffers who were preparing to certify Biden's election victory. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
I'll never forgive former President of the United States and his lackeys and his bullies that he sent to the Capitol for the trauma was exerted on our staff.
The U.S. House of Representatives moved swiftly to impeach Trump just days after the riot, alleging he was guilty of inciting the insurrection. But the U.S. Senate acquitted the former president of that charge in February 2021.
Is hereby acquitted.
Lawmakers have held numerous hearings on the security failures of that day. In late June, the U.S. House formed a special select committee to investigate the actions of then-President Trump. The panel has issued subpoenas to compel former White House officials and Trump campaign staff to testify about the president's actions that day and the days leading up to the attack.
Find Mark Randall Meadows in contempt of Congress.
The committee is expected to release a report on its investigation before the November 2022 midterm elections, but the findings are not legally binding. In the U.S. courts, 704 individuals have been charged at the federal level with offenses ranging from misdemeanor trespassing charges to more serious charges, including violence against law enforcement and members of the media. Researchers estimate about 70 to 80 individuals involved in militant networks face even more serious charges of conspiracy. George Washington University Center on Extremism Research Fellow John Lewis.
These are the hierarchical domestic violent extremist groups, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, some 3%ers mixed in there, who are alleged to have not just gone to the Capitol to see the speech, to protest, to march, but with a concerted conspiracy ranging from the collection of funds, the dispersal of weapons, of marching up the steps of the Capitol in a stack formation, to leaving guns at a Virginia hotel.
Five people present at the January 6th riot died. The question still being debated is whether the chaos developed spontaneously or was part of a planned insurrection directed by the then President of the United States. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. telecom companies and airlines have been fighting for weeks over the potential impact of 5G wireless services on aircraft. Francisca Lainard of Reuters explains what the dispute is all about.
Does 5G pose a threat to airline safety? U.S. telecom companies and airlines have been fighting over this question for weeks. In the latest development, Verizon Communications and AT&T have agreed to a two-week delay to their rollout. So, what's the safety dispute all about? In early 2021, the US auctioned mid-range 5G bandwidth to mobile phone companies in the 3.7 to 3.98 GHz range, also known as the C-band. In recent months, the US aviation industry groups have stepped up concerns, warning of the risk of interference with flight equipment. For background, the airline industry uses radar altimeters to measure altitude. They help minimize the risk of accidents or collisions by giving an accurate reading of the proximity to the ground. Radar altimeters operate in the 4.2 to 4.4 GHz range. There are concerns that there is not enough of a buffer from the 5G frequencies. Airlines have warned that without an agreement on safety precautions, the issue could disrupt up to 4% of daily flights. So, is this a problem elsewhere outside of the United States? The rollout of 5G services elsewhere has broadly gone ahead without airline safety concerns. Take the European Union. In 2019, the EU set standards for mid-range 5G frequencies in the 3.4 to 3.8 GHz range. They have been taken into use in many of the bloc's 27 member states so far without issue. In South Korea, the 5G mobile communication frequency is 3.42 to 3.7 gigahertz band. There has been no report of interference with radio waves since commercialization of 5G in April 2019.
That's Francisca Lenard of Reuters. In other news, the deadliest single fire in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania in at least a century has killed 13 people, including 7 children, and sent 2 people to hospitals. At a news conference hours after the blaze early Wednesday, officials said those numbers could grow and that 26 people were staying in a publicly owned house. It was a single-family home split into 2 apartments. The cause is still being investigated. A fire official says there were 4 smoke detectors in the building, but none that appeared to be working. The Philadelphia Housing Authority said the alarms had been inspected annually and at least 2 had been replaced in 2020. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. North Korea tested a suspected ballistic missile Wednesday, its first launch of the new year. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
North Korea welcomed the new year with a missile launch. Japanese officials say it traveled for 500 kilometers before splashing into the sea off Korea's east coast. The North has frequently tested short-range ballistic missiles since mid-2019. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida called the launches truly regrettable in comments to reporters. The test comes just days after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un delivered an end-of-year speech where he pledged to continue bolstering national defenses to deal with an unstable international situation. But most of the speech focused on Kim's plans to jumpstart his country's economy. It contained none of the usual bombastic rhetoric or threats toward the United States. Mason Ritchie is a professor at Seoul's Hankuk University of Foreign Studies.
Clearly, they're broadcasting a sense of, you know, self-reliance and continuing to remain inwardly turned in some way. And then to follow that up with a missile launch is a sort of, you know, classic kind of cognitive dissonance move that they tend to pull off.
North Korea likely has additional motivations for such a launch, including shoring up domestic political support, testing key new technologies, and demonstrating deterrence against the United States and its allies. North Korea has not conducted an intercontinental ballistic missile test or nuclear test since 2017. Such a move would presumably risk a firmer response by the United States. North Korea is prohibited from any ballistic missile activity, including launches of any range, by a series of United Nations Security Council resolutions. But since 2019, the U.S. has downplayed the North's short-range launches, presumably in an attempt to preserve the possibility for future talks. North Korea has ignored repeated offers by the U.S. to restart negotiations, saying Washington must first drop its hostile policy. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
China's foreign ministry on Wednesday urged caution and dialogue after North Korea fired a suspected ballistic missile off its east coast. Speaking at a regular news conference in Beijing, Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin urged all parties to, quote, bear in mind the bigger picture, unquote, cherish the hard-won peace and stability of the peninsula, and stick to the use of dialogue and consultation to reach a political settlement, unquote. North Korea's first launch since October underscored leader Kim Jong-un's New Year vow to bolster the military to counter an unstable international situation amid stalled talks with South Korea and the United States. Authorities have vowed there will be no disruption to Africa Cup of Nations soccer matches, despite some being held in area of Cameroon where separatist militants have increased their use of improvised explosives. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
The soccer mascots are out, and so too are the soldiers. This is Limbe. It's one of the cities in Cameroon playing host to the Africa Cup of Nations, which kicks off on Sunday. It's also been hit by years of separatist violence. Security has worsened recently as armed groups increased their use of improvised explosives, to the concern of those like Limbe-based journalist Kuma Onore.
My fear and the fear of many Limbe denizens is that the recent phenomenon
of bomb blasts, which has been happening in other parts of Fako Division, like in Buya, can be a common phenomenon during this AFCON period.
Limbe is located in the southwest region. It's one of two English-speaking areas, the other being the northwest region, where armed groups are trying to form a breakaway state called Ambazonia. More than 3,000 people have died and nearly 1 million forced to flee since the conflict broke out in 2017. AFCON Group F matches, comprising Tunisia, Mali, Mauritania and Gambia, will be hosted at Limbe's Omni Sports Stadium. The nearby regional capital, Buya, where some Group F training will take place, was hit by two explosions in November. One in a university wounded 11 students. Emmanuel Ledouin-Gamba, senior divisional officer in FACO territory, says AFCON is taking place in the same context as the African Nations Cup, or CHAN, held in Cameroon in 2020.
So I can't reveal here the measures that are being put in place, but you should know that just as CHAN took place under very good conditions, AFCON will also take place under very good conditions. There are no worries. There is nothing to worry about.
The conflict began in the Anglophone regions when teachers and lawyers protested against their perceived marginalization by the primarily French-speaking national government. A violent crackdown by security forces radicalized the separatist movement. Today, armed police, gendarmes, and soldiers are positioned at Limbe's major intersections. Checkpoints have been set up, and the authorities are promising there will be no disruption as the soccer tournament gets underway.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Gene Rockwell in Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On his recent trip to Indonesia, Southeast Asia's largest democracy, Secretary of State Antony Blinken outlined five elements needed to promote freedom, economic opportunity, and safety for the people of the Indo-Pacific. Number one, says Secretary Blinken, is the need to advance freedom and openness in the region.
We mean that on an individual level, that people will be free in their daily lives and live in open societies. We mean that on a state level, that individual countries will be able to choose their own path and their own partners. And we mean that on a regional level, that in this part of the world, problems will be dealt with openly, rules will be reached transparently and applied fairly, goods and ideas and people will flow freely across land, cyberspace, and the open seas.
Second, we seek to forge stronger connections within and beyond the region, said Secretary Blinken.
We'll deepen our treaty alliances with Japan, the Republic of Korea, Australia, the Philippines, and Thailand. Those bonds have long provided the foundation for peace, security, and prosperity in the region.
Third, we will promote broad-based prosperity, said Secretary Blinken. The United States has already provided more than $1 trillion in foreign direct investment in the Indo-Pacific. Moreover, the U.S. is developing an Indo-Pacific economic framework to pursue trade and the digital economy, among other areas of shared interest. Fourth, the United States will address the dual threats of COVID-19 and the climate crisis. The United States has sent more than 100 million vaccine doses to the Indo-Pacific. And regarding the climate crisis, 15 Indo-Pacific countries, including Indonesia, recently signed the Global Methane Pledge to cut emissions by 30% over the next decade. In the last 5 years, the United States has mobilized more than $7 billion in renewable energy investments in the region. Finally, in recognition of evolving threats, the U.S. will bolster Indo-Pacific security, said Secretary Blinken.
We'll see closer civilian security cooperation to tackle challenges ranging from violent extremism to illegal fishing to human trafficking. And we'll adopt a strategy that more closely weaves together all our instruments of national power, diplomacy, military, intelligence, with those of our allies and our partners.
The United States will continue to be a steadfast partner in making the Indo-Pacific more open and freer.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.